Welcome to Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. Does bailiff have a docket sheet by chance? Can't tell the players without a program. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have three cases on the afternoon docket, two on the 1:30 docket. And the first case is Danielson against Naki. Am I pronouncing those names correctly?
Stop your name. Nate?
Okay. And the second matter is People against Ragusa. Our counsel here on that case. Okay. As you know, there are 15 minutes aside for argument. The red light indicates the argument is finished. The yellow light alerts you to 5 minutes remaining for purposes of rebuttal, if you so choose. We have read the briefs in these cases, and we're very familiar with the facts. At least one of us has been into the record to review those facts. So if that helps you in streamlining your presentation, so be it. I'd ask that all cell phones and pagers be turned off so that the arguments aren't interrupted. And with that request, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Bruce Jones, registration number 11370, on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants, Margaret and Stephen Danielson. This appeal raises an important issue in medical malpractice litigation in Colorado, the extent to which documented risk, commonly referred to as informed consents, can be discussed in a case where the plaintiff is alleging negligence in the performance of a surgical procedure, and not that she wasn't informed of the potential risk. The case gives the court the opportunity to elaborate on its decision in Lisio, which was decided in 2003. While we've raised two other issues, the admissibility of an insurance card and the award of cost, I intend to rely on the briefs on those issues unless the court has questions, and otherwise focus on the informed consent issue.
Mr. Jones, in light of the importance of that distinction and recognizing that it is a pivotal issue, why wouldn't counsel ask for a cautionary instruction right up front and alert the jury to the difference between informed consent and negligence cases?
Because we had raised it by way of a motion in limine, Your Honor, to exclude it altogether. It was our view that when you ask for such an instruction and distinguish between it, it actually has the impact of emphasizing the issue rather than diminishing the issue. So that our view was, let's not bring it up, let's raise it through the motion in limine. The court ruled in our favor on the motion in limine and said it was not to be mentioned.
Well, with that trial tactic in mind, once the cat's out of the bag, why not a cautionary instruction?
Because we continued to ask the court to exclude the evidence, and the court decided that it would take certain steps by saying, you can't use the phrase informed consent, you can't refer to the actual document that contained the risk, and that was the way of addressing the issue through the court, to then say on top of that, judge, also inform the jury not to refer to informed consent, seemed to be asking him to do what he had already said he wasn't going to do. He wasn't going to allow specific reference to informed consent. So once more, it would be emphasizing an issue that we were trying to take out of the case. To then say to the judge, even though you have said don't use the words informed consent. And by the way, jury, this isn't an informed consent case, seemed to us to emphasize something that we were trying to take emphasis away from.
Well, let me follow up with Judge Graham's question. And as I read the defendant's brief, the appellee's brief, I think it's on page 7, the plaintiff made an opening statement, and then the defense counsel made an opening statement. And according to the defendant's brief, he then inquired of the judge whether he could use the word, in a sense, documented. And then the judge considered that matter, decided that the words informed consent could not be used, but that documented could be. And according to the defendant's brief, and I haven't checked the record on this, but I ask you, did the plaintiff counsel at trial object to the opening statement? The defendant says no.
To the opening statement?
Yes.
I think the defense was referring to the closing statement.
It says, based on the review of the trial, page 7 of the defendant's brief, based on the review of the trial court, committed defendant to say only that it was documented and that Dr. Naki advised plaintiff that the takedown procedure could still result in difficulty and so forth. In a footnote on page 8, the defendant says, plaintiffs did not dispute the accuracy of the substance of the informed consent form, but that the plaintiff's counsel did not object to his opening statement.
You're correct, Your Honor. That is the argument that was made.
Are the facts correct that I've outlined?
The facts are basically correct. There was not an objection after the discussion had already been made with the district court. In other words, it wasn't appropriate to object to that in the opening statement because it was raised with the court beforehand. The court said, this is what I'm going to allow the defense to do. The defense then did that, and to stand up and object during the opening after there had already been a bench conference on what the court would allow was not proper. We had already raised our argument, already said that we didn't think he should be allowed to raise it at all.
Well, one further question then. In the admission of evidence, are we looking at the standard of abuse of discretion?
In this instance, yes.
In that context?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's an abuse of discretion standard, but if the court makes an erroneous ruling, which we contend this was an erroneous ruling, then that is an abuse of discretion to allow evidence under those circumstances. The defendant does not really argue that the standard of Licio, that this type of evidence about informed consent shouldn't come in. He argues instead that we open the door through the opening statement. The opening the door doctrine refers to presenting things in a misleading way by referencing some evidence when, if other evidence was then allowed, would explain that. There was no misleading at all with the opening or any of the testimony of the defendants or of the plaintiff's witnesses, because it was undisputed, and indeed the defense elicited this testimony from the defendant, that the second procedure, which was the focus of most of this discussion about the documented risk, the second procedure was anticipated to be simple. Defendant agreed with that, that it would fix the problem, that it was only going to be local anesthetic, and that it was not thought to be a complicated issue. So we did not open the door by saying anything contrary or misleading compared to what the defense argued. And yet the defendant, having had the motion in limine ruling against him on informed consent, used Licio as essentially the playbook to say, now I'm going to argue every time that something comes up about this discussion of what is the likely course of events here, that opens the door for me to get into the documented risk. And he did over and over and over in the litigation.
And once he did, the trial court offered a cautionary instruction.
The trial court did not offer a cautionary instruction at all. The trial court simply said, I will allow you to get into it, but only in this way, to focus on documented risk. And to focus on documented risk rather than informed consent is a distinction without any difference. It is a distinction that doesn't matter, because you are saying over and over again to the jury, she was told that these were the risks and she went ahead with it. She was told this was the risk and she went ahead with it. The complication that occurred was what she was told about. It therefore could not be negligence. That's exactly what is contained then in the ultimate closing argument by the defense counsel. They say harmless error, and yet it was raised with the plaintiff. It was raised with the plaintiff's sister. In fact, it was the first area of cross-examination of the plaintiff's sister. It was raised with Dr. Naik himself. And when it came time for closing argument, it's important to distinguish what was at issue in this case. There was a very, very complicated causation damages issue in this case. That's why it took 2 weeks to try. The negligence part of the case came down to one expert versus another expert, with the defendant testifying about it and the plaintiff testifying about it. Nearly all the rest of the testimony had to do with this causation issue. That's what defense counsel emphasized when he stood up for his closing. But when he got to negligence, when he got to making the argument that there was no liability, he introduced that very argument on page 50 of his closing. Actually, I think it was page 49 running over to page 50, by talking about documented risk that she knew of. And he goes on, and this is what we quote in our briefs.
Just a moment.
Certainly.
But didn't the document which we're talking about, which we don't have in the record because they weren't admitted, I think they were exhibits S and B. Wasn't that document physician surgical procedure disclosure and patient's consent?
Yes.
What was there? What could it have been that when the defendant, when counsel was speaking of documented, he was talking about the risks that had been documented, not the fact of informed consent? Is that
the context in which it was presented clearly implied that these were documented risks that she consented to for the surgery. In fact, counsel basically said that several times in arguing on why more of this evidence should come in, that the jury already realizes now that what we're talking about is informed consent. And in his closing, he says this was all documented, she acknowledged it, and she signed, said all of those things were at risk. And then his next statement, which we didn't quote
so
in our brief.
Let me stop you. We know what the record says, but that having happened, the court did offer a cautionary instruction. Did I understand you say that he did not? I thought the trial judge said very clearly that we could have a cautionary instruction that says, in effect, that in no way did plaintiff consent to have surgery that's below the standard of care. Didn't the judge offer that instruction?
I do not recall
didn't
that,
your
Your Honor.
Co-counsel say, I believe such an instruction is warranted, and then go on and change the subject to talking about the admissibility of Exhibit S or V?
I realize what you're asking now, Your Honor. In the context of whether those exhibits could come in, yes, he said, if I allow those in, it would be with a cautionary instruction. I don't believe that he said, I will offer that cautionary instruction irrespective of the exhibits coming in.
Did you tender a cautionary instruction at the end of the case?
No, we didn't, because he chose not to admit those exhibits that had that language. And therefore, once again, since it was testimony about documented risk, we didn't want to say, and this is a cautionary instruction about exhibits that didn't come into the case.
I take it from your answer to Judge Richmond's question that you did not, at the time the instructions were offered, offer an instruction limiting the issue to negligence instead of any questions relating to informed consent?
We did not, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, you started by saying you think this, we need to elaborate on Licio. I'm not quite sure why you say that. Do you think Licio doesn't make the point clearly enough that informed consent is not relevant to a malpractice, a negligence case?
I think it makes the point very clearly, Your Honor. I think what it, the elaboration would be on what constitutes opening the door where it comes in irrespective of the fact that it's otherwise admissible and determining whether it is harmful error to have admitted it. And in this instance, we contend it was harmful error to have admitted it. And again, in his closing, he emphasized that. He basically used it as the linchpin for his argument that there was no negligence in this case, because the complication that happened was exactly what she had signed off on before the procedure.
Your Honor, one further question, and I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but on page 13, I believe, of your amended opening brief, you cite the plaintiff's opening statement and suggest, and your answer is that you did not open the door through this statement for the defendant to bring up the question of what he had told her was documented. And you say on the fourth line, and he told her that it would return her, the idea is that it would return her to prior, her prior continence level, or maybe for that reason that you'll hear about leave her completely continent. It does not, in a sense, open the door to the question of risk, what he told, or not the question of risk, but what he told her. You opened the door through your own opening statement.
Not at all, Your Honor, because that, it's, did we say something that causes the jury to be misled? And the testimony from the plaintiff and the defendant both were absolutely consistent with that statement, that the thought was this is a simple procedure, it will fix the problem, and that will be that. Separate and apart from that, there was the documentation about the potential risk. But the discussion they had was exactly consistent with this, that everyone thought it would be a simple procedure. That's why he didn't put her under a general anesthetic. That's why he said, I think you'll be able to go back to work the next day. So there's nothing misleading about that or inconsistent with what the record turned out to be about that statement. What's misleading and inconsistent is then to rely on these documented risks as if those documented risks represented the discussion between them and what they anticipated, when all it really was documents that shows there are risks in any surgical procedure, and these are among those risks. But
so
it wasn't what they were anticipating.
That, that document did not in any way reflect the discussion that took place between the doctor and the patient subsequent to.
Exactly. It was, we think this is going to be a simple thing, and it will resolve your problem. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
May it please court and counsel, my name is Ron Nimero of the law firm of Kennedy, Childs & Fogg, number 15178, and I represent Dr. Vernon Naik, MD. The issue, the primary issue on appeal here, the issue of the use and how the evidence of the informed consent came into trial, is an issue that for obvious reasons is one entrusted to the sound discretion of the trial court. And the reasons I say are obvious because the dynamics of trial are something that the trial court had access to and which are very hard to figure from the transcript that makes the record on appeal here. To deal with this issue, the trial court used its discretion and invited the plaintiff's counsel to help cobble together a solution to the problem that emerged as a result of the opening statement. Yes?
What did you mean, or trial counsel for the defendant mean, when he said documented risk. What were you referring to when you used the word documented?
To the informed consent form. The informed consent form...
Well, that just, that the informed consent form just referred to that there were risks in this search. Is that correct?
It went beyond that.
Well, it went beyond that, but that essentially what is informed consent, that the patient knows that there may be trouble or difficulties arising from this conduct.
It says that and more.
Well, I know what it says. Well, I don't have a copy here.
There is a copy in the record. It was attached to plaintiff's opening statement as exhibits.
But it wasn't admitted as an exhibit.
That's true. It was only used as an identification exhibit.
It's attached to where?
It's attached to the appellant's opening brief as exhibits. On the very last pages, at least on mine?
No, it's not on mine. My brief, amended opening brief, ends on page 30.
Well, then it must be on the first brief and not the amendment.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we'll go hunting for it.
Okay. But the dynamic here is the abuse of discretion standard is applicable here because there are so many intangibles at issue. A review of the record will show that the solution that was reached was one that was reached in tandem with plaintiff's counsel here. It was plaintiff's counsel who proposed that they use the term complications rather than risk. It was plaintiff's counsel that made sure that the informed consent form did not come into evidence. In our brief, we raised the issue that they didn't object to this issue. They didn't preserve this for appeal. And the reason for that is they had input into how it was handled. I would direct this court to volume 2, pages 81, regarding how the opening statement played out and why it became such an issue. And then I would direct this court to...
But yes, but Mr. Nemiro, that on page 14, of the amended opening brief of the appellant states the defense counsel then stated the following in his opening. As you know, before she had that procedure, she was told, and now here's the critical word, and it is documented that she was told that she could have trouble voiding. Now, if the trial defense counsel had just left out the word documented, that simply that she was told that she could have trouble, wouldn't that have been the answer to this case?
I don't understand the question.
Well, why did defense counsel use that word documented?
The answer to that is found a few pages before, and that is in a sidebar conference where they discussed how to handle this issue. And the word documented
the trial judge said, okay, you can use the word documented after the statement of the
trial plaintiff. Judge said that, and with the input from plaintiff's counsel.
What if the trial judge was wrong in the first place?
Well, the question isn't whether he was wrong. The question is whether he took a reasonable approach.
Yeah.
And here, it was a reasonable approach given the way in which the opening was given. The record shows something that's really interesting from an appellate lawyer's standpoint, that there was a pregnant pause in the opening statement. There's a suggestion of that in the record. And one rarely gets stage directions in a transcript. But here the stage direction is important because it shows how that statement was made to the jury. That it was that the doctor, according to plaintiff's counsel, told the plaintiff that the procedure would return her to continence.
Or had certain risks.
Would return her to continence.
Right.
Not that it had certain risks. And that is why it's important to bring in evidence of the risks that were told.
I see what you're saying.
And that's what the whole idea of opening the door is about, as this court made clear in Lisio versus Pinson. The only evidence that the plaintiffs were willing to put on about the statements made to the patient prior to the procedures was that it was simple and straightforward. In plaintiff's testimony, she didn't recall being told about the risks, and yet the informed consent forms she signed are documents that show by her signature that they were explained to her. Same was true of her sister's testimony. She was present at these conversations between the doctor and the patient. She didn't recall there being a conversation about risks, but the informed consent forms signed by both the plaintiff and by the doctor say that these were explained to her. They were as much as a transcript as we have of the trial.
All of which were irrelevant in the context of negligence.
Yes, irrelevant in the context of negligence, but made relevant by the plaintiff, because the plaintiff is the one who said that these were the conversations before trial. They become relevant in this case, first because they go to the credibility of the plaintiff. The plaintiff testified that all she was told was that there were simple and straightforward procedures. And yet there's evidence that she was told more. So it's irrelevant in that respect. But to the same degree that the conversations that plaintiff testified to are relevant in the first place, if it's relevant that plaintiff said, the plaintiff remembered that all she was told was that the procedure would be straightforward and simple, then it's equally relevant that she was told there were risks. If I make a...
Well, I take it that then, that again, referring to the plaintiff's opening statement on page, as noted on page 13 of the amended opening brief, that the words that triggered the opening, which you followed through, which the defense counsel followed through, and he told her that it would return her, the idea it would return her to her prior continence level, or maybe for reasons that you'll hear about, leave her completely continent. And so...
And the words before that would be simple and straightforward.
Yeah, and that sucks me out.
And that leaves an impression that there's contrary evidence of.
All right. Thank you.
There's no dispute by the defendant that informed consent's irrelevant. It's potentially prejudicial. That's what Licio said. There's no dispute by...
We accept Licio.
Right. You, at one point, the defense offered a stipulation to that effect. Isn't that true?
That's correct, and
it was never accepted by the plaintiff.
It was never followed through. It's not clear from the record what happened to that stipulation.
Did the judge offer a jury instruction of the same effect at least once, twice maybe?
The recollection is, my recollection is as Mr. Jones is, that the jury instruction was offered with regard to the admission of Exhibit S and Exhibit V. Mm-hmm. But just as importantly, no jury instruction was requested by the plaintiffs. And indeed...
None was tendered by the defendants either.
None was tendered by the defense. But, and the reason for this was, the silence in the record is because everyone worked together to agree on the approach. When you review the record, I would ask the court to look at volumes 2, pages 115 and 105. And you'll see there the plaintiff's counsel had input in how to handle the informed consent issue. There they said, at 115, it was plaintiff's counsel who asked that the word risk not be used, but that complications be used instead.
This is after the opening statement.
This is after the opening statement.
And before defense opening statement.
No, this is during testimony.
Okay.
This is, as I recall, in the course of, actually, I could look.
We'll find it, sir.
But it is a thread throughout the transcript, and the references to the transcript are in our brief, where that happened. So
is it invited error?
Well, I was thinking about that as I was preparing for today, and we didn't make that argument. But we did make the argument that it wasn't preserved, and the reason it wasn't preserved is because it was a corroboration. I think about it, that it is invited error, and that it was part and parcel of what the trial court did was with the plaintiff's input. And if there are no further questions on that, I have nothing further to say.
All right, Mr. Nemiro.
That's fine.
Sure. Mr. Jones, we peppered you with a few questions and probably knocked you out of any chance for rebuttal. But why don't you take a minute and a half and rebut? You don't have any objection to that, do you, Mr. Nemiro?
No.
Just trying to be fair here.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the invited error issue, it was not invited error for this reason. When we objected to this evidence coming in. And the court said, well, I'm inclined to let something in. Yes, we worked with the court to try to limit it to be as non-damaging as possible, but it's not invited error because we didn't say let the evidence in from the outset and then object to it. So that's not at all invited error to try to work with the court in light of the defendant taking the position that I ought to be able to introduce it altogether and the judge say I'm going to let some evidence in on this. Naturally, you argue, well, I want to try to tamp down as much of the harm that this would cause as possible. The only other thing that I would comment on from Mr. Nimero's argument is that with respect to the documented risk, that is the heart of the issue because it goes to the idea of saying she was told that these bad outcomes could happen. She signed off on it. They were documented for her. And if those bad things happen, she has basically agreed to it in advance. It's completely irrelevant and prejudicial. That's what Licio is saying. It's not just that it's irrelevant, but it is prejudicial to allow that evidence in under those circumstances.
One question, if I may. My sense of these cases is that the jury is persuaded not by hearing the word documented or non-documented or whatever, but however the jury verdict comes out, is that they're persuaded by the so-called experts in this case. And I think you mentioned earlier on, this was, or perhaps it was the trial judge, mentioned something to the effect that this was, in his cost analysis, this was a heavy documented case where expert A was saying it was negligence and expert B saying it was not negligence. Is that a too simplistic approach?
Your Honor, I've only been trying these types of cases for 20-some years, and I haven't figured out exactly what causes the jury to decide a given case.
When you do, let me know.
I will be writing books about it because I think that there are instances where it is which expert does the jury believe. But I think there are other instances where the jury pretty much says, discounts the experts because that expert said one thing and this expert said another thing, and then it becomes very much what the parties talked about and was the plaintiff treated fairly by the doctor, did the doctor treat do what the doctor needed to do. And in this circumstance, if that is what was driving the decision, like consistently bringing up that she was warned that this could happen and she went ahead with it, I think it places the plaintiff in a very disadvantageous position with respect to the way the jury evaluates the case. That's our argument.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Nimero, for your arguments